This podcast is brought to you by Monster.com. For your employment needs, contact us now to find the right hire. Tennessee football did.
Menace to society.
All right, welcome back. Thanks for joining us for episode 7. I just want to start this off by sharing a story that was shared with me on Monday. It's very close to home. My son, I mentioned it a couple times, is a 9-year-old travel baseball player. He plays for an organization here in Columbus called the Olentangy Sticks, and the experience has been honestly awesome for my family and my son. It's been really cool to watch. And they shared a story with us via the coaches for the Sticks about a kid in Central Ohio that I wanted to send prayers and condolences to him and his family, a kid named John Mullins. Was an 11-year-old baseball player here in Columbus, and he apparently in a game, I think it was on Monday, wasn't feeling well, collapsed at the plate during an at-bat, and actually passed away a day or two later. And so we're going to share the GoFundMe information on our social media, any support we can give this family that's going through a trying time and obviously a devastating, tragic situation. We just wanted to try to bring light to it and really send prayers to the Mullins family because it's a really sad, sad situation. I also want to start this show off by kind of sending a shout out and thank you to Joshua Perry and Dave Biddle. They did a podcast and someone tagged us in it and we listened to it. It was actually a really, really good podcast. Joshua Perry Show is I think the name of it. And then I think Dave has one called the Bucknuts Morning Five, but they discussed a lot of things, one of which was this podcast, and Joshua provided some decent insight into this movement, kind of me as a coach, and debunked some things about me that he thought were astonishing that people would believe, mostly that I was some unhinged, unintelligent human. But I was really, really appreciate them approaching the topic, because a lot of people in the media don't want to approach this show. For whatever reason, I guess it's the history that I have, or the debacle that I went through. Either way, they don't want to mention it. Now they'll take the content from this show and write articles about it, but they don't want to give credit or mention that they listen. I think it's like I don't want people to know that I listen to that guy. So I just appreciate them actually approaching the topic and being honest about the fact that they listen, they enjoy it, it's entertaining, they find it very valuable or whatever. So just want to send them a thanks. Also want to thank you for tuning in. Since last I feel like every episode I have to update you on how successful this is going. But we reached a milestone that I thought would be months out. And within 1 month, we hit it. Actually, this morning I checked and we had hit it. We have now surpassed 100,000 listeners and downloads. So we're up to like 9,000, 10,000 downloads per day. And it's out of control. And so I want to remind everyone, just go ahead and hit subscribe, however you're listening to or experiencing this podcast, this show. Make sure you download it now on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or go to our website at menacetosociety.com. We've also started accepting advertising and sponsorships, partnerships, interest. And in the next month or so, we will be solidifying the minimal sponsors and advertisers we select that we feel are a good fit. I want to make sure that, you know, we've had some great opportunities presented already. We're working through those, but we're not just going to pick anybody just to monetize this show. We're actually looking for partnerships that fit, that make sense, and that are, I think, beneficial to both us, our partners, and our listeners. So that'll be coming in the next month or so. If you're interested in any way, feel free to reach out to me. My email is Zach, Z-A-C-H, at menacetosocietypodcast.com. That's the number 2. Also wanted to mention, I mentioned it last show, it's going to come probably in the next month or so. We're going to start a partnership with Patreon, which is a way to offer a VIP experience to our listeners, give you some extra benefits, extra info, extra merchandise, things like that for joining. And then we also have done a lot of work in the last week on a merchandise line. I mentioned it before, if you're a fan of anyone that Texas plays next year, we have a couple shirts that are just absolutely awesome. So West Virginia, TCU, Oklahoma, Iowa State, Baylor. If you guys want a hilarious shirt to wear for Tom's visit to your town, make sure you stay tuned to our social media and our website. Also, pre-order is going to open up in a few weeks. We're going to pre-launch the store, the merchandise shop, and start taking pre-orders on the first four shirts or so, or five shirts that we put out there, so that we can kind of get this thing ball rolling. We also are going to kind of revamp our entire website. We're going to add written content to it. We're starting an email newsletter. So if you have not reached out to our show yet via our website, go to our website, hit contact us, send us an email. We'll log your email and sign you up for the weekly newsletter that's coming here in the next couple weeks.
Zach, I think you should put some of your rings and memorabilia on there to sell. I don't know if you want them or not, but I think they'd go.
You know what? That's funny. I've been thinking about that a lot, because I have countless priceless things that I look at now and I'm like, I don't even want this. I mean, I have rings, just jerseys, helmets, you name it, and I'm like, it's not like a proud thing in my life anymore, like to wear these rings around. I used to wear my latest Ohio State ring after everything happened, kind of as a more of a middle finger to the people that just absolutely sold me down the river, and also because I do love Ohio State still. But yeah, if anyone has any ideas, I thought about donating them, or maybe trying to sell them to raise money for something. If anyone has any ideas, reach out, because I have 10 rings, probably 10 helmets, 10 jerseys. I got all kinds of stuff that I don't know what to do with and I don't really want.
Okay, well, let's get into some feedback from the last episode and some of the things people brought up. Obviously, we talked about the top 10 atmospheres.
Yeah.
And on social media, we got quite a few questions about a couple omissions from that list. And I just want you to talk about those for a minute.
Yeah, the biggest one, I think, was Virginia Tech. And it's definitely, for me, an honorable mention. And the thing about Virginia Tech is, and I've watched it on YouTube, I've watched it on TV, on some of these Thursday night games. Virginia Tech Thursday night, that's like the cemetery of good college football teams. And so we played there on a Thursday night, and it was loud. It was a really cool environment. The only thing that we didn't get to experience as coaches and players was the Enter Sandman, which I think if you don't experience that, the entrance from Virginia Tech, I don't think you can really evaluate it fully. So I guess my apologies for not including them. That is probably a top 10 atmosphere. But the best part, I didn't get to see. I didn't get to witness. I just have seen it on the internet and on TV, and it looks awesome. I mean, looks crazy. And it was a loud stadium, but it was just okay. And obviously the game was in our favor. Sometimes these atmospheres are a lot more hostile if you're getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, I mentioned it after the show, actually, about Virginia Tech. So I'm not surprised that we got a lot of feedback about that.
Yeah.
But I remember the one play that stands out in that, what was that, 2015? It was when Braxton Miller had his coming out.
Oh, the circle button.
Yeah, he hit the circle and just juked those
Braxton
two guys.
Miller, spin move.
Oh, yeah.
So that was probably, people ask, what is one of the coolest experiences of your career? That's got to be one of them, because I knew Braxton as our quarterback, didn't know him that well, you know, when he was a quarterback, just as well as you know a player on the team that you don't coach and kind of superstar. I mean, two-time Big Ten player of the year. He has two silver footballs. So I got to intimately know Braxton leading up to that season. And the kid went through a lot. Obviously, he got injured against Clemson in 2013, hurt his shoulder, had to have surgery, did an insane rehab to try to kind of speed up the healing process with our trainers and our doctors and try to get back for the 2014 season. And I'll never forget when he went down in training camp in 2014. I've never seen a practice event quite like that. When Noah Brown broke his leg going into 2015, it was similar. It was one of those, when it happened, practice stopped, time stopped, Urban stopped, everyone was sick, and he was on the ground screaming. I mean, he threw like a 5-yard swing pass check down and blew his shoulder out again, and it was devastating. And the whole team, it was like, I think we had halfway through practice, we ended up speeding up practice, calling it, because it was no energy, just awful. Everyone felt sick and disgusted and just devastated for the kid, because they knew the hard work he put in. And so I never forget, we were walking back, and prior to that season, Tom Herman, Charlie Strong had just got hired at Texas, and his first hire attempt was he tried to hire Tom Herman as his OC. He knew Tom was a Texas guy, this innovative guy. If he could make a splash hire like Tom Herman, pulling him from Ohio State. So he offered him $1 million a year. And Tom was making, I think, $500 a year at Ohio State. He offered him the job, and Tom turned it down. And he turned it down just in talking to him because he knew he had Braxton coming back. He knew we were loaded. 2014 was going to be possibly an epic year, maybe a Braxton Heisman or a national championship. And that would be the catapult to get him a head coaching job. And so he came back to Ohio State. And then I'll never forget, after Braxton got hurt, we're walking back to the facility, Tom and I, because we practiced kind of off-site. And so we would always walk or jog back. And so we're walking back, and he looked at me. He said, "Zach, what the fuck did I do?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I just turned down $1 million. And now our quarterback's gone."
Yeah.
And it was just, you talk about foreshadowing and like an epic moment in hindsight, because he was devastated that he didn't take the job and that this injury might have just derailed his, you know, calculations and his thoughts into why. And then obviously, sure enough, you see what happened. What he was able to do with the quarterback position with JT Barrett that entire year, then JT gets hurt, and then he transforms Cardale Jones, and just his ability to take those three quarterbacks and prepare them kind of made him the QB guru, got him the Houston job. So it ended up working out exactly how he wanted it to for himself, selfishly. But it was one of those moments where you're like, God, if you could rewind, 7 months later, like, "Hey, Tom, you're going to be all right, buddy."
All right.
But back to that transformation. So Braxton, then after he re-injured it again, had another 12-month rehab process. And so probably about June leading up to the 2015 season, you know, Braxton and Mike Thomas are still and were back then like best friends. They trained together. They worked together back from when they were QB wide receiver duo. And so Braxton came to me with Mike one day, early June. And they both walked in, and Mike was like, "Coach, I got a gift for you." And I was like, "You got a gift for me?" I'm thinking, what is this? Like, got me some wings from Wingstop? Like, what are you talking about, a gift? And he said, "Brax wants to talk to you." I was like, "All right, what's up, Braxton?" He said, "Coach, I want to switch to receiver. I want you to work with me and train me and get me ready." I said, I got you. All right. Have you talked to Coach yet?" He said, "Nah, I'm not trying to talk to him right now." I said, "Well, Braxton, I don't think he'd receive it well if you and I are out there working and making you a wide receiver and the head coach doesn't know that I'm doing it. I think he might get pissed about it."
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I'm not telling you what to do, but when you're ready to make that official and go tell the head coach, like, we can get it in. So I talked to him about it, talked to him about how to approach it. And so finally he went and talked to Urban. And so we started meeting Braxton and I, start getting ready, start transforming him from a quarterback to a receiver. And he didn't want anyone to know. He didn't want people in the program to know. He didn't want anyone like trainers or anyone that could leak the information. He was really funny about it getting out, which unfortunately for me during my summer, that meant that I was going 4 or 5 days a week at like 10 p.m. We'd go to the Woody and get an hour session in of drills and stuff like that just to get him ready to transform into a receiver. And it was really rewarding. And here's the thing that people don't often realize. When you convert a quarterback or a running back to receiver, you're taking an athlete that is used to playing on a horizontal plane and trying to convert them to a vertical plane. And here's what I mean by that. A running back, if you look at how they stand pre-snap, they're even feet, right? Maybe slight stagger, but even feet. Quarterback, even feet. Everything they do is hips and shoulders square, and everything's horizontal jump cuts, horizontal movement, whereas a receiver has a vertical plane, right? They are lined up with their feet in a vertical position. They're running linear. They're having to stop and completely change direction and go the opposite direction, right? And not to get too technical, but that is a very unnatural thing for someone to do that has never done it. And so that was what we spent the next 3 months on. And I think the progress that Braxton made, if you could have seen the first workout compared to what he was when the season hit, it was night and day. And he was so unpolished and had a long way to go to be an NFL receiver, which is why right now, I mean, he's doing okay. He's obviously on some rosters, but he's still growing. He's still getting better. I mean, he's played receiver for 7 months and then went to the NFL. But that Virginia Tech game, after the game, he obviously had a great game. I think he had 2 touchdowns, the spin move. He had a corner route he caught down the sideline for a touchdown. He had a major impact. And that was the first time in over 2 years he'd had an impact in a game when he was the most electric and impactful player in the country. And so I'll never forget it. On the field, he was getting interviewed, pulled this way, that way. And when I finally saw him, I mean, he just started sobbing and gave me the biggest hug of my career. And it was just like, thank you so much, coach. Like, he was like hard to, he couldn't talk. He was so emotional. And you just saw this kid that was so invested, wanted to be great, wanted to help his team, wanted to be relevant, and went through all the adversity of injury, which people don't talk about enough. College football is such a now sport that when a kid gets hurt, it's like the next kid's up and you forget about that kid until he's back healthy. The adversity that they go through when they get hurt, the mental health aspect of it, you go from being extremely busy in the spotlight, grinding, working, all of a sudden, poof, you're bored. Yeah. You're hurt, sitting in an apartment alone, sitting in the training room while the team's practicing. You're doing all these things, and it's like, it was just really cool to see that happen for him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I know wide receivers are all about catching passes and stuff, but how much blocking did you work on with him? Because I know
a lot.
Wide receivers have to block a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I kind of prided myself on because, you know, if you catch 10 balls, you're still playing another 45 snaps without the ball. So
exactly.
you have to be a great player without the ball to play. And so, Braxton, we worked a lot on it. And you know what? There was an interesting dynamic with Urban and Braxton because that was his quarterback. That was his guy. And so if he was in there on a run play, Urban would lose his shit at me. Like, why is he in there? And I'm like, well, Jesus, I can't put him in only when he gets the ball. Plus, he was a proficient blocker. Like, by the time season hit, certainly by midseason, he really could block. He's strong. He's athletic. And he had a desire to. But it was like this stigma that Urban had with Braxton, like, don't let him get touched because he used to be the quarterback. And it's like, all right, well, he's not the quarterback anymore. Right. He's going to have to block the walkout linebacker. I'm sorry. Like, or it's like Braxton's in. And that's what happened. You watch what happened that year. He was a toy, a shiny toy for Urban. And that's what he got utilized as. He got utilized as this toy that was like, put him in, do this trick play, just get the ball in his hands, put him in as a wildcat quarterback. And it's like, we never just let him play wide receiver. That's what we did initially, but once he had success, it was like an obsession with Urban would come in on a Monday and say, here's the Braxton package, and he'd give you 10 like bizarre plays, and some of them really cool, some of them worked. I mean, it's not knocking that approach, but we never let the kid play receiver.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, his first game, or the Virginia Tech game, was really his biggest game, and I know a lot of fans, I've heard it, came out afterwards and wanted to know, like, what happened? Where'd he go?
Well, that's what happened. Yep. We went into that game, and the whole focus was how we beat Virginia Tech, how we beat this defense that we got exposed by last year. And so there was no real conversation about what are we going to do with Braxton special and how are we going to do it. It was more about what do we need to do to win the game. So Braxton just played receiver. He rotated with Curtis Samuel. We had four guys out because they failed drug tests. Three of them were receivers. And so it was basically like, you have no option. Braxton's got to play receiver. And he did. He had a great game, great impact, major impact. We still did some cool stuff with him, like some jet sweeps. And it was excellent. And then because of that success, we completely got away from it, which makes a lot of sense, right? But that 2014, that's another question I've gotten a lot about, is the 2014 season. And Virginia Tech, it was one of those chess matches that they called checkmate. They did something that was well calculated, well thought out. Here's what they had. They had a guy named Bud Foster, for those that aren't.
Bud Foster.
For those that aren't familiar, the defensive Drink. Guru. And that's not one of those titles that comes without basis. He is and always and was a defensive guru.
Well, they love to show him. No, I always had a drinking game. If you see Bud Foster or hear Bud Foster's name, you take a drink and you will get messed up.
Well, you know, these in-game analysts, man, they're looking for side stories, and Bud Foster was definitely a side story. So he had this vaunted defense. He played this too high, sometimes inverted defense that was kind of his staple. He was a guru. It was his what he was known about. Like, you know, Monty Kiffin's known for Tampa 2, and all these mm-hmm. these defensive gurus have their niche, their defense that they're just experts at. And his was this inverted quarters cover 2 type of defense. And so we went into the game thinking, no way, this guy's a guru. He has an ego. He's going to show how his defense can stop our offense, right? That's what he's going to do. Bullshit.
No.
They went all offseason, all spring. We evaluate the spring practices, the spring game. We evaluate two-a-days. If there's like a special the ACC Network does, we're going to watch it. We evaluated everything, and everything just showed them playing their defense. The first game of the year, they played a nobody team. I don't remember who, but it just played their defense. They come into our game and played, what is a 5-down lineman. They call it a bear. Everyone in Ohio State knows about it because they heard about it.
It was all man coverage.
It was all zero coverage, which is man without help.
Man without anything.
Yeah. And then five linemen up, bear defense, and just load the box. And their moral of the story was, we're not going to let Ezekiel Elliott beat us.
Yep.
and we are going to have an extra player for the JT Barrett run game. Or Braxton, you know, whoever was the quarterback was going to be. It was JT.
It was JT.
But it could have been Braxton for all they knew.
Wasn't that one of it? It was one of his first games, maybe second game.
It was his second game. It was.
So he just wanted to load the box and put pressure and make JT beat him.
Absolutely. And so what you saw was a couple things happen. One, you saw JT get exposed a little bit because he was young. He was wet behind the ears. You know, he wasn't ready to take on a secondary like that. The receivers were caught off guard for sure. I didn't do a good job preparing them for that coverage style. And then also Urban got exposed, because when Urban sees zero coverage, with zero coverage is just man coverage with no help behind it, he just gets so excited to score that he just wants to throw a go route every time. And what was happening was JT, because they were, I mean, it was a max blitz every play basically. Mm-hmm. And then whoever blocked the extra blitzer, the guy playing him in man coverage would blitz too. Like when he saw his guy block, he'd blitz. And so what you saw was JT's getting hit. Every time he throws the ball, he can't step into his throw. He can't make a good throw. And we still had some big plays. I mean, Mike Thomas took a slant, I think 65 yards for a touchdown. He took another slant, like 35. And I'll never forget the play that really set that entire game, the momentum and everything, turned it against us. And when I felt like, this is not going our way, we were in the red zone. They're playing zero coverage. I think it's third down. And so we're going to take a shot to the end zone, right? We're in the red zone right here. And so we're going to just put one receiver to the field, right? Put everyone else in the boundary, get a one-on-one with all that field to work, and we're going to just throw an isolation. And so Urban grabs me. He goes, "Who do you want in?" I said, "Mike, for sure, Mike. Especially hindsight, Mike." And he goes, "No, put Corey Smith in." And don't get me wrong, Corey had an outstanding camp and was a really talented player, but he wanted to know who I trusted to make the play. It was Mike. And I said, "Coach, I'm telling you," he looked at me, he said, "I said, fucking put Corey in." I said, "Yes, sir, put him in."
Jesus.
Corey ran a post, beat the shit out of the corner. He was one of the more talented route runners and fluid receivers I've been around, Corey Smith was. And then sure enough, dropped the ball.
Yep.
Dropped the ball, we don't score. I think we missed the field goal, and then they come rolling. And I just, God, I reflect on that so many times. Like, could I have stood up to him? And the answer is probably no.
Nope.
But could I have stood up to him more and demanded, pounded the table like we talked about before, had more conviction to put Mike in the game, because Mike was pissed.
It sounds like he pounded the table at you.
Well, he pounds the table
but over. But he does it all the time.
Yeah, he pounds the table over everything. But, that was one of those, I don't know, talk about regrets. It really, I still get pissed at myself for not, like, demanding that Mike go in. And it's nothing against Corey, because Corey made some plays in that game, but he also wasn't as reliable and consistent as Mike. We just weren't prepared for that game. And I wanted to talk about another thing that has been asked quite a bit. A consensus question is, how does a staff game plan for a game, right? How do you go into Virginia Tech and who's to be held responsible, right? And so I wanted to kind of break down how we did things, just a quick overview to give people perspective and kind of a view of what goes on in pretty much all college football programs. So without going into the calendar, which at some point maybe I will if people want to hear it, but how a game plan is put together. Obviously, you have an offensive coordinator who's driving the ship, right? He's in charge, organization, and responsibilities, like just giving each coach ownership in something, right? And so most of the time, every coach works on first and second down. It's the majority of your downs. And so every coach will have like a formation or two or three to go break down, watch the cut-ups, and evaluate what they do against that formation, and put together a plan how we can attack their defense, right? And then you end up being apart for 4 hours in the morning on Monday, and then you come back together and you start going through each formation and talking about them as a staff. And the coordinator has last call, but as a coach, you know more about your formation than anyone else because you studied it for 2 hours. And so you present what you want to do. And so that's first and second down. You go through all of that, and then you get into situational football, which is obviously a huge part. It's the money downs, third down, red zone, short yardage, goal line, like when it's fourth and one in midfield, when it's fourth and one on the 1 yard line, like what are you going to call? So each coach will have that. Like my big deal in my time at Ohio State, I always was the third down and red zone coach. As the receiver coach, probably going to throw it. So that was my responsibility. So if anyone wants to evaluate me, you could go and look at how we rated on third down and red zone. And not that it was all me. I mean, all you do as an assistant coach that is not the coordinator, if you're in charge of third down, you put together a plan. And then obviously the quarterback coach is going to work with you because his guy's you know, the star of the show. And then the whole staff will listen to you. The O-line coach will talk about how to pick up their blitzes. You do all these things to try to prepare, right? And people have also asked, do you script the first 10, 20 plays? And I think every coordinator does that. In my experience, everywhere I've been, including not Ohio State, including programs outside of Urban's program, it's like, let's script the first 5 to 10 plays, right? And they script these 5 to 10 plays. And then after 2 or 3 plays, you're completely off of it. It's a complete waste of time.
You just throw it away.
Well, yeah. I mean, the situations change. Yeah. Like the defense had a game plan. It might not be exactly what you thought. You have to adapt, adjust. I mean, this is a chess game going on, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's always funny when it's like when we talked about game planning the first 3 opponents, like a complete waste of time. But the first play of the game was huge, and that was Urban. Urban picked the first play of every game. If we didn't run a good play the first play, it was 100% of the time Urban Meyer's play. But he would give players ownership. He'd be like, hey, he'd grab Mike and be like, hey, I like how you've been running the post corner this week. Might open a game with that sucker. Or whatever. It'd be maybe a trick play, or it might just be a hand Zeke the ball to get him started, or what. It didn't matter, but Urban made the call, and it was like a something that was important all week. Like, this play had to look good in practice on Tuesday, then had to look good again on Thursday for it to get called in the game. And we used to come in Fridays. Friday's a stressful day for a coach because you don't have practice. All you have is a walkthrough. All your physical preparation's done. And so when you came in Friday morning to watch the film as a staff, if any play, because Thursday, so Urban called Thursday perfect Thursday, right? You come in Friday, it better be perfect. It better be perfect. And if it's not, it's going to be an explosion and he's going to want to throw the play out of the game plan if it wasn't executed the one time you ran it on Thursday. That's how serious it was. To the point where, I guess I'm going to shit on this guy every show, but Ed Warner used to come in and right after practice on Thursday and make the video guys delete plays.
Oh, no way. Oh,
like and Urban a couple times was like, didn't know how to approach it because he would see it like, Curtis Samuel dropped the ball on this play. Well, that's not perfect. And so Ed would come in and be like, hey, you got to delete that play that Curtis dropped it. And then you come in and Urban would be like, I don't remember seeing the Curtis drop. And then Ed would flat lie to him. Oh, yeah. You know what, coach? I think you were out of the room. We saw it. But the one thing that he always did, this is when he was the tight ends coach specifically, is if his guy fucked a play up, he deleted it, threw it out. And then we'd have to rerun it. And the next play, let's say we executed it perfectly, except his guy. He'd delete the play. And the next play, the players are kind of like, man, what the hell? And so, like, the play didn't look half as good because they just ran it. And then all of a sudden, every other coach is getting blown up because their guy missed a block or wasn't going hard or whatever. It's like, well, he's not going hard because we just ran it. You don't know that because it got deleted. And it's like, it was just, getting back to the dysfunction. I could talk about it all day. I'm going to stop, though. So anyways, I wanted to get into that. Kind of got off topic there because we were talking about some omissions from the top 10 atmospheres, right? And the next one that people brought up was the Florida-Georgia game. What used to be called, and now it's like politically incorrect, is the world's largest outdoor cocktail party.
Yeah, you're right.
That's right. And so there must be a larger indoor one.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a
of course.
There's a big time dome cocktail party somewhere that we don't know about that beats it. But so the Florida Georgia game is a cool atmosphere. I'll give it that. The 50-50 split. The stadium's half red, half orange, and blue.
Half orange and blue. It's right at the goalpost. The goalpost. It's like a straight line.
Yeah, it's cool to see. The atmosphere itself in the game and the stadium is very average.
Yeah.
So I guess to put some criteria on that list was game day atmospheres in game, like the experience you have during the game, right? And so the Florida Georgia game during the game is just okay. I wouldn't put it top 10. Now, that being said, it's one of the most unique college football events in the country. And the atmosphere outside from friends and family that went to the game, the atmosphere outside is a must see. I mean, it's insane. The tailgating, and we saw it when we'd come from Gainesville and you roll into Jacksonville over this bridge and you just saw tents everywhere.
Yeah. Don't they throw out like gators on a noose?
Oh, yeah.
Out on the street. Oh, I saw that.
And so the atmosphere outside looks unbelievable. And I know they had the place called The Landing in Jacksonville that I mean, hundreds of thousands of people are there after the game that night. And I've heard the weekend is insane. Obviously, I never was able to take part in that part. But the game itself's not anything to write home about. But that game was epic. Some of the battles we had, I know in We beat Georgia there in 05, 06. And then in 2007, I don't know if you guys remember, that was the disrespectful dancing on the field.
I was at that
one.
Well,
that was after the first touchdown, right?
They first touchdown.
Rushed the field. They're first, in all black.
Mark Richt.
First touchdown.
Threw them out there.
The whole team, the whole Georgia team rushed the field. And nowadays, the whole team would get ejected for it. and that was the rule back then. But I think the refs were as puzzled as we were.
They didn't know what the hell was going
on. What do we do? Do we eject the whole team? Yeah.
Then I guess forfeit? I don't know. I
mean, eject the coach.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you do. But yeah, that was crazy. That was that game was insane because we had come off the 06 National Championship. We knew we had a young team, an inexperienced team, not a great team. And that was – they silenced us and completely exposed our lack of confidence, our lack of leadership, and our lack of ability to get through adversity. And they were fired up to take back the respect that we had taken from them the previous two seasons, and we were not prepared for it to defend our respect.
Do you remember the final score? I thought it was a blowout, but I could be wrong.
I don't remember the final score. I'll tell you what, I remember the final score the next year.
Yeah.
2008, the response.
I'm sure you do.
49-10. I'll never forget it because that was the game that Brandon set the tone for the whole game. Brandon Spikes met Knowshon Moreno in a hole, just absolutely flattened him, and then stayed on top of him face mask to face mask and let him know.
Brandon Spikes, he's probably the best linebacker I've ever seen. Yeah. He's a monster.
Middle linebacker, he was a beast. And yeah. he was intimidating, man. He's huge.
He's huge.
I mean, just huge with the dreads. I mean, yep. And when he talked to you, he talked. Like, he was like, reminded me of like Ray Lewis when you watch Ray Lewis. Like when he spoke, it was like, ooh, I got goosebumps. But that was, I'll never forget the end of that game. Time winding down. I don't know if any Florida fans or any college football fans remember this. Time's winding down. We're up 49-10. We have our threes in, just running the ball. And I mean, still our threes are getting 8, 9, 12 yards per play. And about a minute left, Urban calls timeout. And I'll never forget it because I actually was down from the box and I'm standing right next to him just enjoying the wind, like the atmosphere, like you do if you blow somebody out. And I remember the ref did a double take. He said, you want to call timeout? And Urban was like, yeah, I said timeout. Call timeout. And so he looked over, I think, one of the Pouncey twins, and he was like, how pissed do you think he is right now? Thought like he'd get like a little boost from one of his star players. And I think it was Mike Pouncey looked at him and said, bet you won't do it again. And then sure enough, he didn't even break eye contact with Pouncey after we had just ran the next play. He kind of leaned over to the ref and said, timeout again. Called timeout again. And our fans that were still there, the Georgia fans were gone, but the Florida fans were going ballistic. But yeah, those were two epic games. The other school that I want to address because people made a couple good points were made about it. Oklahoma, I talked about how I was really unimpressed, and there was two great points made. One was we beat the shit out of them, and it is hard to evaluate an atmosphere in an ass kicking. It really is. And also, what I didn't think about was the fact that there was this long weather delay, lightning delay, and that just takes the wind out of any sail of a stadium. So that definitely is one that might be higher. I'm sure if you went to Oklahoma State, it probably is great.
Oh yeah.
But it just, my one experience there was just average. So I just wanted to address those because had some great feedback and people wanted a little more perspective, a little more insight. So wanted to bring that up.
All right. So now let's talk about some current events, something that's in the news today. Yesterday, I wanted to talk about it. Michael Thomas, he's in contract negotiations. He is, looks like he's set to be the highest paid wide receiver in the league, which I think is correct. I don't know about you.
Yeah, it's that time of year for that draft class. You know, 3 years in, the guys that have had success, it's time to renegotiate and kind of get a legit contract because the way the NFLPA and the NFL has everything set up now, it's pretty well outlined and concrete on what your contract's going to be based on your draft status, your draft placement. And so Mike is one of the fortunate ones that performed really well, and he's going to get paid. And the number I saw was around $23 million a year. Which for a receiver is obviously it'd be the highest contract for any wide receiver. I was looking at it. He's had a record-breaking 3 years, right? More catches than any receiver in the history of the NFL in their first 3 years. That would average out to a $23 million contract, $185,000 every time he catches a ball.
Wow.
Also, that would average out into $2.5 million for every touchdown he scores. So I bring that up because that's astronomical, right?
Like that's insane.
That seems like a high price for production, especially for the most productive guy at his position. But here's what I want to bring up about Mike and about why they would pay someone that kind of money at that position.
And it's because they're not just signing a wide receiver. They're not just signing a guy who's going to get open and catch balls and score touchdowns. In the recent history of the NFL, there's been a lot of guys that do that, right? Dez Bryant is a great example. I mean, he had unbelievable production, but he never got paid like that. Why? Because Mike is not just a wide receiver. He's a culture driver. He was for us. He is for them. I actually, in conversation with Mike when he first got to the NFL, because he was a grinder. I've talked about it almost every episode. He was a grinder. I mean, he was doing stuff that I didn't even know was possible from a football player. Talk about commitment. You talk about work ethic. And I remember talking to him his rookie year, and he was like, Coach, I try every day to beat Drew Brees to the facility or stay longer than Drew Brees, because Drew Brees is widely known in the NFL as one of those grinders, one of those guys that just works so hard, a pro. And Mike and I used to always talk about it, and I used to talk to my players about it, about being a pro. You want to be a pro, you got to treat your body right. You got to fully commit yourself to your craft of playing this game, right? He said, Coach, I'll come in at 6 a.m. We're not supposed to be there till 9. I'll come in at 6 a.m., go in the training room, and you know, start to get my body right before practice or meetings. He said, I'll walk in, and it'll be like dark, lights off, and I get in there, and I'll be start my routine, and next thing you know, Drew Brees will walk out of the sauna. Like, son of a bitch, he beat me again. And he used to talk about how it was impossible. He's like, I've never seen somebody work this hard. And then Sean Payton told me a story, actually, after his second year, he came in town for pro day. And we're sitting, him and the GM and a couple of their scouts were sitting in the hallway with me and Brian Hartline and Urban. And I had a side conversation with Sean Payton about Mike, just because I wanted to hear about how he was doing in his eyes. He was like, I'm going to tell you what. He was like, I've been in this game for a long time, and I've never seen someone like him. He was like, I think he's going to get me, like, fined or fired with the NFLPA, because we go to walkthroughs, and there's no, like, walkthrough for him. Everything is full speed. Everything is trying to get a game rep. You know, in the NFL, you're not allowed to do that. You go to a walkthrough, you're not allowed to run. It's like in the Players Association contracts. Like, yeah. And he said, every time I'm like, Mike, you're going to get me fined. Stop. I mean, they video practice. I mean, the NFLPA can watch it. Yeah. And he's like, it's one of those things that just the way he ticks is different. So that's why you pay Mike Thomas $23 million a year. Not only is he the most productive receiver in the NFL right now, but he is what you want for your team, your culture. And he is going to increase success for the entire team outside of production. And so I wanted to talk about it, one, because it's my guy and I'm really fired up for him. He's going to get rewarded for all the hard work he paid off, and it's well-deserved. But I also want to talk about how they're not paying just for touchdowns and catches. They're paying for culture. One of the other things I saw in the news, some interviews, and then a number of people asked me about my opinion on the new coaches at Ohio State. And the only two that I know are Greg Madison and Al Washington. And I wanted to talk about them for a minute because Buckeye fans specifically want to know what is coming into Ohio State. And I think I'd hate to break it to Michigan fans, but they're two really great coaches.
That's probably their two best coaches that got away.
I mean, it was a huge loss, and I mentioned it before. Huge loss for Michigan, huge gain for Ohio State. I've known Greg Madison since 2005, and he's one of the best coaches and recruiters, that old tried and true coach that is just really, really good at his job. He was when he was first a DC at Michigan, we kind of had his number. He had some old school way of doing things that we kind of exposed, but he's still a phenomenal football coach. And you saw it with Don Brown and him co-coordinating the defense last year and the year before. He's an excellent football mind, an excellent coach, and he's actually a really good recruiter.
Well, didn't they have the number one defense in the country?
Another coach I'll talk about is Don Brown. He is elite. His defenses at Boston College were outrageously good, and Ryan Day worked with him. He worked for Steve Adazio, who I had a good relationship with. And then when he got to Michigan, he flipped the whole defense. I mean, just turned it around, and the stuff he does on defense is excellent. And so Don Brown is another coach, kind of randomly, to talk about that I think is one of the best defensive minds in college football. And he's no joke to prepare for. That's one of those you buckle up and get ready to prepare for that guy. But and Greg Madison obviously took a lot from him and helped him a lot. And so that's going to be a big addition. And Al Washington, I don't know. I didn't work with. I know him. I know him pretty well. He's a very energetic young coach, very business-like professional. He's going to be an excellent, excellent thing for Ohio State in that linebacking core. So I wanted to mention that. Also, previewed it last week. Want to get into what is the state of college football today? What I call a Dabo versus Saban with a sprinkle of Lincoln. Just kind of reviewing it. The one thing I do want to bring up, that's the three top head coaches in college football.
Yeah, it's a three-horse race.
I don't even think you can argue much outside of that, right? Yeah, no. It is right now Dabo, Saban, Lincoln.
Well, maybe Washington.
Kirby Smart. I mean, Georgia's been in the mix, maybe.
Right. Maybe. But those three are, I think, a level above. You could throw maybe Kirby. Maybe Chris Peterson. But
maybe at some point.
But if you're going to call a top three, I think that's right, pretty consensus, top three. And for here's... Sure. The good thing for Buckeye fans and Cleveland Brown fans is the new in vogue thing is promoting from within, right? If you have a very successful program, or even in Clemson's case, it wasn't successful. Two of those three head coaches were promoted from within the program, just like Ryan Day just was. And so at one point, people were saying, Lincoln Riley, what head coaching experience does he have? Or Dabo Sweeney, who is that? And look where they are today, top three coaches. So that, I think that's promising for Buckeye fans that there's a model that really Clemson started it, Oklahoma followed it, and now Ohio State's followed it. The Cleveland Browns followed it.
With Freddie Kitchens did it.
And you look at it, so Nick Saban is 27-2 in the last 2 years with a national championship, right? And he is recruiting on a different level than anyone else. I mean, his last three classes are like number one, number five, number one in the country. He is, having recruited against everyone, they are the premier opponent to recruit against. I mean, if you beat Alabama, that's one of those you like are sweating. You're like, oh my God, give me a Gatorade. That was a bitch to do. Dabo, 27-2 also in his last 2 years, won national championship, obviously last year. People have been critical that I said they were the other school that was extremely hard to recruit against, and they are. You can take rankings as far as, or for as much worth as you want, because I think they've been ranked 7th and 10th the last 2 years. But when it came down to great players signing, Clemson was always in the mix, and they signed a bunch of them. I don't know where they were ranked, but they are recruiting at a very high level.
A lot of DNs.
Their defensive line.
The defensive line is
ridiculous. And the receiver signees have been phenomenal, and obviously I know that very well. And I know their receiver coach very well, and they do a great, great job with certain positions. And then Lincoln Riley's 24-4 in the last 2 years. With both of his years as a head coach, they made the college football playoffs. Obviously, they haven't pulled one out. He's 0-2 in those appearances. But I think that's a testament more to the Big 12 inferiority than anything. Because Oklahoma is playing, when you watch college football, at that level, Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State level. But they get to the playoffs, and the Big 12 inferiority is exposed.
Well, they took Georgia to two overtimes.
They did.
They were close.
Right. I mean, they're not far off, but you got to win the game.
Yeah.
and they're also recruiting at a very high level. I mean, they're top 10 classes in his three classes. I mean, that's outrageous that a first-time head coach can sign three top 10 classes in his first 3 years consecutively. And the one thing I'll tell you about last year's class, obviously I was out of college football when it was signed, but you know, you recruit those kids for 2-3 years. Yeah. What they signed last year on offense is insane. They signed the number one quarterback in America. They signed the number one and number three receiver in America, and then two more receivers in the top 20. I mean, they're recruiting at a very high level. They have that Southwest region locked down. I mean, they're going into Texas.
They're probably taking Texas.
They pulled the number one receiver in the country out of Georgia.
Wow.
So, I mean, I'm talking about... They're recruiting at a different level than Oklahoma has. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely think it's a three-horse race right now going into the season, and then we'll see who can, you know, come out of it as a fourth, fifth program that can challenge those three, because I don't see those three falling off much this fall.
All right, well, I think it's about time to get into some Q&A.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Our first question comes from Jim Hisser. Would love to hear you talk about that ass-whooping Florida gave the Bucks back in 06. That game still haunts me. We were so good. What happened?
You know what? I think it goes back to what I referenced earlier, kind of the state of college football, the Big Ten, SEC, where we are today, where we were then. And what you really saw was the exposure of the speed differential between the SEC and Big Ten in that game. And I'm not talking about the skill players. There was no one faster on the field than Teddy Ginn, and I know he got hurt. But there was no one. There was speed at Ohio State, but where the difference really was not even the skill players. The skill players were pretty equal. It was in the big skill, the linebackers, running backs, tight ends, and then more specifically, the linemen. The defensive line we had at Florida was freaky. I mean, they could run like you've never seen in the Big Ten back then, and so you saw that speed differential exposed on a national stage. And so when we walked into the game, I mean, we thought we were in for a dogfight. And obviously the first kickoff, and it was like, oh, shit. Like, Urban Meyer's a coach from Utah. And we're in the show, the dance, man. And we go in there, and that Ted Ginn takes that kickoff back, the opening kick. And, I mean, you could hear a pin drop on the headset. It was like, holy shit, we're not in Utah anymore. And then, sure enough, I mean, we weren't fake. It was for real. Florida was for real. And we got there. I mean, we had two DNs that were top 10 picks that year and the next year. Jarvis Moss and Derek Harvey.
Derek Harvey.
And then we had some interior D linemen that were ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what James Laurinaitis, I heard him talking about it. He plays this game and he said, you know, what if Teddy Ginn hadn't gotten hurt? And then he goes, but that wouldn't have solved the problem that our tackles couldn't fucking block the D end.
Yeah, for sure. It was just, and it's not even that the tackles weren't good players. I think it's just they hadn't seen some freaky shit like that in the Big Ten.
Yeah, he says, we were so good, but what is that compared to?
Right. I mean,
like, well, who's he good against?
If you remember, they were calling for a rematch, Ohio State-Michigan rematch that year. It's like, right. Calm down. But yeah, I think that's what really started this exposure, this differential between the SEC and Big Ten. And it's they still are fueling that argument with that, going back to that date. I mean, that's what it was. It was an exposure of a speed differential between the SEC and the Big Ten.
All right. Our next question comes from Spencer Johnson. How do you feel about Clemson's recent rise to the top of college football? Was the blowout over Alabama a fluke, or is Clemson really that good? Also, do you see Dabo leaving Clemson for Alabama in the future?
Let me tell you something. There's no such thing as a fluke blowout over Alabama. It's not possible. So, no, it's far from a fluke now. And this has been a long time coming. If you watched, I mean, we played Clemson twice and got beat pretty handily both times. The first time, not as bad as the second time, which we will talk about that at some point. I know a lot of people have reached out about it. But this is not a fluke. I don't see Dabo leaving. If he does, I'd be absolutely shocked. It would have to be some astronomical number, because what he has going at Clemson right now is, I mean, he's coasting, man. He's got a brand new multi-million dollar facility, great college town, great area of the country, great place to recruit, and he's got a great staff that really don't leave. He's got Brent Venables, has been his DC forever. He's got Jeff Scott as his OC, who is the wide receiver coach, who I know personally. And you just look at how they recruit. They recruit really well. They recruit that Eastern Shoreboard, that Virginia Beach area, the Maryland area. Then they go all the way down and recruit Georgia really well, South Carolina really well, North Carolina really well. I mentioned it before. They go into Tennessee and take players all the time. They go down to Florida a little bit. Tampa, for sure. Tampa is a huge Clemson area. Look at some of the great players they pulled out of Tampa. They're hard to beat in Tampa. So I don't think it's a fluke. I think they're there to stay until something happens. But to say they're going to be out of the conversation at any point in the near future would be ridiculous. Like I've said it 100 times, them and Alabama are the hardest two to beat in recruiting, and Clemson was one of the hardest to beat on the field. What Brent Venables does on defense is phenomenal. What he does is he studies your formations, the way you line up, I mean, like a science. And he doesn't call the defense until you're lined up. And so it becomes this chess match of, like, can you get the play in and can you go fast? Or can he see your formation? Now you got to battle all your tendencies. And it's a very high-level chess game when you go against Brent Venables. And they do a great job at Clemson. So, no, it's not a fluke. I don't think Dabo would leave unless it's for, like, $12 million a year or something crazy. And I think that they're for real. They're there to stay.
Okay. Wendell Jack wants to know, why do you end with the San Diego comment?
So, a couple people have asked that. It was just something funny that we did the first show, and I'm going to keep it going. And if you don't know what it is, you need to go watch Anchorman.
Obviously,
it's what it came from. It's the he reads anything on the teleprompter. And we threw it in there after that comment about Ed Warner not being able to call a play. And I just kind of ended the show with it the first time, and we're going with it because it's funny. And one of my best friends in the world lives in San Diego. So I texted him. I said, hey, I shout you out every show. But yeah, that's why we do it. Don't see change in it. But if you don't know about it, go watch Anchorman. It's pretty funny.
Our last question comes from D'Artagnan. Who is the best or top two teams you've ever coached, Zach?
So the best two teams, I'll classify them in 2 years combined because it was relatively the same team, you know, minus a couple players lost, would be the 2014-15 Ohio State teams and then the 2007-2008 Florida teams. Mm-hmm. Those are the two best teams by far that I've ever seen or been a part of. And you know what? I think that I'll do a written kind of breakdown on the website in the next week or two comparing those two teams and maybe even have a segment on the show about it, because I don't want to sit here and ramble about it. I want to really compare them, because those are the two of the greatest teams in college football history. I don't know if they're the two best, but those are two of the greatest when you look at the personnel, the success on the field, how they were winning games, and just the dominance. Those are by far the two teams that were the best in my career. And so I think that's a great conversation. If there was some time warp or time machine, you could make those two teams play. Oh, that would be epic. So those are the two. But I think that's really all the time we have for Q&A. And we're going to go in the future. We're going to add a third show moving forward next week. And it's going to be not the same format. It's going to, because we don't have time to get to all these questions. We've gotten so many questions and great questions that we want to answer. So starting probably next week, we're going to start putting out written content on the website, a Q&A kind of question and answer, so we can answer some of these questions in multiple formats, and also open up a third show a week, which is going to be strictly Q&A. It's going to be strictly you ask questions, I'll answer them, and we'll talk about them and just kind of get that content out so that we can increase the organic content we have in these shows, those two per week, and then add the Q&A as a third. But getting into a preview of what we're going to get to, like I said, we're going to add that Q&A show. We're also going to get back to our top 10 segment, start to go through our top 10s. We're talking about explosive players in the country, most explosive players all time in football, top 10 programs over the next 5 years, my projection, some top 10 segments. And then we're also going to start a new segment we're going to call If It Happens. And the first If It Happens is going to be if Urban Meyer is singing Fight On in the near future and is the head coach at USC, who is his projected staff? And I hate to break it to you, Buckeye fans, but Mickey Marotti and Mark Pantone will be house hunting in SoCal. We also didn't get to what I wanted to discuss about false accusations, some of the experiences I've had and that I've seen with players that people don't really know about, and kind of the injustice to some of these players in false accusations, and going to move into kind of a what happened to them story time about some of the great players that were recruited that I know about that kind of disappeared because either they didn't make it, something happened. And I want to talk about that. I also want to start a show consistent recruiting segment. We're going to talk at least one recruiting story, a show, or it's something recruiting oriented. And then later this summer, kind of something big we're working on is trying to do a live podcast show. We're working out the details and the venue, probably in the Columbus area, but we want to do that. I think the support will be there, and if you're interested in that, please reach out. Again, you can go to our website and contact us. Also going to be launching the Menace to Society store on the website soon. We're going to have some great podcast show apparel, the Menace to Society show. Some Zone 6 apparel. I know people have been asking me for that since I was a coach. We're going to have some t-shirts, maybe dog tags, helmet stickers, some of the stuff that the brand that I created that Ohio State embraced. We're going to really try to provide that to the fans because we know that they'd want it. And it's not just for Ohio State fans. That is, Zone 6 was really a movement that was really went nationwide. There was receiver corps all over the country that started adapting that Zone 6 mentality. So we want to provide merchandise and product for them to buy and wear and take on that brand. And then also a trash talk line, which is going to be really fun. There's going to be some hilarious shirts from the show topics. There's going to be two that I know right now, awesome Brett McMurphy shirts that I will wear them probably every day. But just definitely check that out on the website. Make sure you subscribe and download now on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, and visit our website at menacesocietypodcast.com. Like I said, it's going to be revamped in the next couple weeks, so looking forward to that. And we've I want to mention again, we've started accepting and looking into advertisers and sponsors, in no rush to do it. But if you're interested or know someone who might be interested, please reach out on the website or contact me directly at Zach, Z-A-C-H, at menacesocietypodcast.com. That's the number 2. And so if you like the show, we appreciate it. Thanks for tuning in again. Hope you were entertained. Hope you learned something. Hope you took something away from it. And if you didn't like it, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
Menace to society.